Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 26, 2019. This is the third week of our 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the first of a series of talks on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha teaches the Four Foundations of Mindfulness as the framework for what occurs during meditation and as a reference for mindfulness in all areas of a Dhamma practitioner's moment-by-moment life. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. A mind that is that completely distracted to be in a trance state, there's absolutely no opportunity for insight, is there? Shamatha Vipassana. So we'll talk more about it today. And
middle way.
See you Tuesday, my friend. So last week we reviewed again, and on an ever deepening level, Shamatha Vipassana meditation, and the talk was on jhana, how we use meditation to continually deepen concentration, and for no other reason, and all of that rests on the proper use of mindfulness as the Buddha taught mindfulness. And so I'll always preface this by saying I'm not dismissing or denigrating other applications of mindfulness. Most of them are somewhat benign, but some of them can be lead to deeper distraction. I won't get too deep into that. The only point I'm making is that the Buddha taught a very specific application of mindfulness that begins in meditation. So you can say that right mindfulness and right meditation go together. We can't develop right meditation without knowing what to hold in mind. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. So in the present moment, the framework of the Eightfold Path guides how we see what's occurring and what we should be holding in mind. The recollection part, as it relates to the Dhamma, is that situationally, from a mind that is well concentrated and understands the various themes of the Dhamma, is able to recollect them appropriately, think what we want when we want to think that. And that's really, I think this is going to be a two-part talk on the Satipatthana Sutta because there's a lot here. The first part of the Satipatthana Sutta teaches us how to meditate, what to do, and it's very simple and direct. The remaining portions of the Satipatthana Sutta are how to apply a well-concentrated mind to utilize the other factors that are included in this sutta to refine our mindfulness. The reason why I'm saying that is much of the other practices that we'll get to probably next week are taught as meditation practices. And as we had that talk before, most of that means that we're not meditating anymore. We're simply contemplating conceptual and objectified themes of the Dhamma. So the Buddha taught, here's a good example of it. One of the most famous modern Buddhist teachers, and I'm not putting him down and I won't mention his name, teaches, I think it's either 5 or 7 mindfulness practices. And that kind of encapsulates that whole lineage. They're all nice. They're all be mindful of being compassionate, be mindful of generosity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're all wonderful human qualities, but none of them are part of a Dhamma practice. One of them that just comes to mind is be mindful of doubt. Well, to be mindful of doubt and overly mindful of doubt is actually to cultivate doubt. It's not just accepting that it's here. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So creating a mindfulness practice of contemplating doubt in no way could deepen our concentration, could it? Rhetorical question. So the Buddha taught to deepen concentration, to support the integration of the entire Eightfold Path so that we are naturally capable, compassionate, naturally loving, naturally honest. It's an aspect of our awakened human being, not something that's contrived and fabricated because it's how we think we should be. See the difference? And so a mind that's constantly grasping to act in accordance with a set of rules is always a mind in conflict, isn't it? It's always against itself. It's built into that idea. The Buddha recognized this. He recognized that the debilitating stress that comes in a mind like that, it's always grasping after being better than it is, and realizing the root cause of a lack of compassion or dishonesty or fear, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is not because the person itself is bad or lacking something. Remember the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. A person is just made up of four elements and the space property and the consciousness property, the six properties that make up a human being. There's nothing lacking in that person except what has conditioned that person to act in a less than compassionate, loving, honest, etc. way. So creating concepts of this is how you should be doesn't get to the root cause of why it's not or why I'm not the way that I should be. And it's because of fabricated views. Everybody has that? Kathy, do you?
I'm sort of following along with you.
Okay.
Just keep going.
Well, just to briefly touch on that, the Buddha awakened to his profound understanding was that it is ignorance of four noble truths that leads to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing stress and suffering. That's called dependent origination that we're going to get to, I think, week six or seven or eight, maybe. And from dependent origination states, from that initial ignorance comes fabrications. Fabrications are corrupted or perverted ways of looking at ourselves in relation to the world around us. So the heart of the matter isn't the fact that I can't be more compassionate. The heart of the matter is that I am ignorant of what I really am. Again, that's the Buddha's great realization. And so then he taught a path not to be better than that mind rooted in ignorance can possibly be. He taught a way to recognize that ignorance and abandon it. And as they say in the army, be all you can be. I throw that in there. It went 10 years to use that line. watch out now. And this is being that type of person, someone made up of those six properties without an I in it, is the essence of calm. It's the essence of a gentle and meaningful life. Because now I don't need things to be different than they are. Is that relatively clear? Because we're going to get to that part today. And that's the essence of mindfulness. The essence of the Buddha's mindfulness is a dispassionate and selfless way of being in the world and holding in mind what's occurring. Another way of saying is that we learn the difference between approval and acceptance. I don't have to continually approve what's occurring in relation to me. In other words, am I getting my needs met? Does this make me happy? Is there something here that's taking away from me? All that falls away. And I'm simply present with life as life occurs. Why? Because I understand the Four Noble Truths, including and most profoundly the first one. Unsatisfactory experiences occur. Dukkha occurs. And when I'm no longer part of the equation, when dukkha occurs, which it will continually, I don't care. And it's not an aloof type of not caring. I am completely present for things that used to drive me crazy before, but now I'm not. Now I'm simply living a life. So let me get to it. So again, the Buddha taught four foundations of mindfulness. Notice the word. They're the foundations of mindfulness as far as mindfulness is used within the Buddha's Dhamma. There's endless applications of mindfulness. Let me just use one example because it fits me well, and maybe, well, it fits me well. I'm a recovered alcoholic and drug addict. A very debilitating aspect of mindfulness is the kind of mindfulness that had me drinking and drugging around the clock. I couldn't stop recollecting and holding in mind the next cheap shot of vodka. And because this is an extreme example, but all compulsive behaviors are exactly the same way. Maybe just not quite as extreme. We cannot not think of what it is that we're compulsed about, and ultimately, what I'm compulsed about is continuing to establish and defend me. And as we know in dependent origination, my view of me is fabricated, it's corrupted, but yet I'm going to go ahead and keep trying to establish it. Using that example that I just gave, and I've seen this happen, unfortunately, to hundreds of my friends, will allow that compulsive way of thinking to kill us because I can't get out of that feedback loop of this is what I need to be happy. In my case, it was another shot of vodka. But we do it with all kinds of things. We do it with shopping. We do it with sex. We do it with golf. Pick one. We do it with Facebook and Twitter. Imagine if that wasn't going on. And we can do it with the idea that I'm going to be the most compassionate Buddhist there is in the world. even though the outcome is much more pleasant for ourselves and other people to experience, usually, unless you get caught up in the Crusades, that's the same self-establishment as I need a drink of vodka. But I've now substituted a compassionate path or a bodhisattva path, the Mahayana path. And as long as I can fit myself into that ideology, I'm good to go, as long as that's maintained. And so we get very defensive over these conditioned positions that we make. Now, back to the four foundations of mindfulness. The Buddha recognized this ongoing series of I-makings, ongoing self-referential events in our own mind, that he realized he needed a way for the individual, not for him as the savior Buddha, he wasn't one, for individuals that would develop his Dhamma to see themselves doing this, to recognize the feedback loop. That's why we use mindfulness in the Buddha's Dhamma. And there's four foundations of that that he taught. And these foundations are first established in meditation, then off our cushion, we take that concentration and integrate the entire Eightfold Path as our Dhamma practice. Is that clear to everyone? That's why we meditate.
That's a lot of information.
So let me stress it again this way. We concentrate so that our minds are well concentrated enough to hold in mind the other important principles. That's the essence of refined mindfulness. And the overarching principles are right view, right intention, right speech, action, livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Again, a lot of words, the first time you hear that, probably the first 20 times, you might not even remember all eight. I didn't. It took me a while to remember just what they were. But once we know that, that becomes a reference for our Dhamma practice. And we don't have to know in profound and exquisite detail every part of right effort. We just have to hold in mind that right effort is continuing with Dhamma practice and being gentle with ourselves. Right intention is the intention to recognize in this moment and abandon craving and clinging. Right view gets us headed in profound right view by simply, in the beginning, accepting that my view right now is fabricated. It's rooted in, and we know it's fabricated because I don't have complete knowledge of Four Noble Truths. Remember, dependent origination, from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's not saying that we're just ignorant people because we're human beings. We're ignorant of a specific topic. If you never learned how to change your oil, you're ignorant of how to change your oil in your car. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means you don't know that, right? Okay. I've been threatened to do the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Now I'm going to do it. On one occasion, the Buddha was in Kamasadana, where he addressed those assembled. Friends, there are four frames of references. Four frames of reference. Four foundations of mindfulness that, excuse me, that are required for the purification of all beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and regret, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for establishing the right method of practice, and for complete unbinding. There are four foundations, and only four. The Buddha didn't teach other mindfulness practices. Some of them might be helpful, but most of them will, when you try to, and this happens often, when you try to incorporate other mindfulness practices, you might have learned from a charismatic teacher or somewhere on a video, and make that part of your Dhamma practice, you're distracting yourself from what the Buddha's teaching. And so that's not to say that you shouldn't incorporate other mindfulness practices. I wouldn't, but if you do, keep them separate from what the Buddha taught. In other words, don't conflate the two, or else you'll lose what the Buddha's saying here. What are these four, the four foundations of mindfulness? We do this every time we meditate. Being mindful of the breath in the body, determined and alert and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. It simply means to be mindful of your breath. And then when you get caught up in your thinking again, like you hear in my instructions, simply recognize you're distracted, come back to the sensation of breathing. In other traditions, we talked a little bit about counting meditation. That's often taught to beginners because the poor beginner, I won't be sarcastic. Because the beginner has such great difficulty in the beginning of meditation. So let's give them an easier method. But when you substitute that easier method, you're simply substituting a beginning a meditation practice, because counting numbers or counting sheep or counting anything is not mindfulness of the breath. And it's something that at some point is going to have to be abandoned. The more you use it, the more it's going to be difficult to let go. And you might find, again, I'll use myself as an example. My first meditation method was transcendental meditation. which is a mantra-based meditation. And they give you that there's a ceremony, and you're given this secret word that nobody else has, and you can never, ever, ever tell it to anyone. Mine was Hrim. I later found out that they pick from these seven, they're called the root words in Kriya Yoga. It has nothing to do with nothing, but there's only seven of them. Mine was one of them. So I think it's okay if I say it to you. Anyway, I don't use it. I did for about 2 years until TM wasn't taking me anywhere. But even after I stopped, many years later, in fact, it probably occurred 20 years later, I'd be sitting in meditation, this meditation method, and all of a sudden I find myself stuck on my mantra again, because I had so conditioned myself to do that. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's just another thought at that point, come back to the sensation of breathing. So if we condition ourselves to use different meditation methods, such as counting, or visualization, or chanting, or this gentleman I mentioned before, he really substitutes walking meditation for sitting meditation, it's going to be very difficult to go from that way of thinking to simply be mindful of the breath. But so the Buddha taught a foundation of mindfulness beginning with be mindful of the breath in the body, no matter what's occurring. Very simple. It's always with us. Number two, be mindful of feelings arising from the sixth sense base, determined and alert and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. Again, we're sensitive and conscious beings. Excuse me. As soon as we sit down in meditation and become mindful of the sensation of breathing, for most of us, a feeling or a thought is going to grab our attention. It's going to arise. What the Buddha's teaching, again, it's something that has developed that is so contrary to this, is when a feeling arises, recognize that a feeling has arisen and come back to the sensation of breathing. Period. Don't analyze it. Don't label it. Don't figure out who's to blame for the feeling. Any of that type of contemplative or analytical work is simply a distraction, isn't it? And even that idea, that's the other common method of teaching beginners to meditate. Whatever comes up, put a label on it. Well, what is a label? A label is my self-referential view over what's occurring, isn't it? I'm using my meditation practice, a mindful practice, in a mindless way, or to increase mindlessness. The Buddha recognized that. In other words, there's no reason, we don't have to remake the wheel. The Buddha taught this very simple, very direct, and incredibly powerful and effective meditation method. The problem is we want to keep adapting it. Excuse me. And we want to keep adapting it, and the adaptation seems reasonable because they allow us to be comfortable in our distraction from deepening concentration, from doing jhana. Is that clear? Is it really? Mm-hmm. All these other little methods that we make, they're just another distraction. They feel good to many, many people, great, you know, millions of people, because it's an accepted distraction rather than grabbing a shot of vodka, mm-hmm. you know, or playing too much golf, et cetera, et cetera. So these very subtle but powerful strategies that we now incorporate into our meditation practice and are widely accepted simply become more distraction. And more distraction from recognizing ignorance. When we are mindful of feelings arising, recognizing that I'm caught up in a feeling, I'm distracted by the feeling, I simply come back to the sensation of breathing. And by doing that directly, we are teaching ourselves to be dispassionate about all of our feelings and not be distracted or reactive to our feelings. That's a concentration practice, isn't it? There's nothing magical or mystical about it. We're not recreating the wheel. We're simply doing this simple practice. The next foundation of mindfulness, and it's similar to that, is being mindful of thoughts arising from the sixth sense base, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. The first one is craving and aversion to the feelings. That's what's occurring. And this one is avoiding any reaction to my thoughts that are occurring. And how do we do that? I'm mindful that I'm caught up in my thinking again. I come back to the sensation of breathing. As soon as I start labeling, analyzing, or contemplating my thoughts, another big aspect of the insight meditation is to, and I'm going to briefly synopsize what they do just to point out the difference. They're usually on a 10-day silent retreat. The first 3 days are towards what they call shamatha meditation, not shamatha vipassana. They teach you to use your breath, to calm your breath. And then the rest of the retreat is to first calm your breath and then to be mindful of all of your thoughts. And just, it kind of like this random type of mindfulness of thoughts arising and passing away. The contradiction to the Buddha's teachings is pretty obvious there. There's no value in and there's no insight into analyzing or massaging or encountering or engaging in thoughts that arise and pass away, is there? When thoughts arise, when feelings arise, we recognize that and come back to the sensation of breathing.
It's such a subtle,
very subtle difference.
Absolutely. Twist,
yeah.
To make it a distraction.
Yes, there is. But look at what that one step does of analyzing or labeling. It takes us from a mind that's distracted. I'm coming into my meditation practice. My mind is distracted. I had a busy day. I'm going to come and be mindful of the breath and body. And now I'm caught up in my thoughts again. Now my meditation teacher has told me to look at those thoughts. See what they feel like. Where are they directing me? What am I doing? I've added one more
level
away from my initial I'm just simply more distracted. That's why I call it mindful mindlessness. And it's one of the most accepted types of so-called, and I'm not putting people down. There's thousands and thousands of practicing so-called Buddhists that do just that. And that's fine. I have no problem with that. I did it for a while. I went on some of those retreats. What I'm saying is that an awakened human being taught something completely contradictory to that way of teaching meditation. And that's the only reason I'm emphasizing it, is that it's so common today. Please.
David just pointed out that, you know, it's so close to be on the right track and on the wrong track. I find in my thinking, where I think I'm going wrong, is that I am trying to, change myself.
Yeah.
Because I know that I'm in wrong view. Maybe not all the time, some of the time. therefore, I need to change myself. And I get caught up in trying to...
You need to get into right view.
Change myself. And that's a fine line in your thinking to... just do what the Buddha's asking and release your thoughts, not try to change your thoughts.
Yeah.
And that's a very fine line, and I get lost there, and I end up being hard on myself there.
Yeah, that is where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? It's our self-referential thoughts that got us here in the first place, and that is simply another subtle but powerful self-referential thought. I'm doing it wrong. It won't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so how do we? What's the vehicle that we've learned to recognize and abandon those thoughts? The Eightfold Path. Again, you're describing why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, because we get caught up in those self-referential views, and when we identify with them, this is my thinking. My thinking is I can't develop right view. What happens? You can't develop right view.
Mm-hmm.
Until you recognize and abandon that if you go into meditation to change yourself, you've missed the whole point.
Yeah.
Because what happens? Change. You know, impermanence is the number one thing. So we have, impermanence itself isn't random though. We can support what the experience of is in the next moment, because we can change our thinking, and we do it by stopping changing our thinking. Sounds like it's one of those paradoxes that I really hate to because they're kind of bandied about in modern Buddhism, the great paradox. But when we try to change our thinking to go from a wrong view to right view, we're in trouble. When we simply develop the Eightfold Path in a dispassionate way, including meditation, it occurs as a consequence of being on a path. That's why
you can do jhana, but you can't do the Eightfold Path.
Yeah, you can only integrate it and express it, really.
Right. The Eightfold Path is a manifestation of your level of concentration.
I would say the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path is directly related to a well-concentrated mind.
I have a question, though, but if you are meditating and a thought comes into your head that's really, you know, a pretty nasty thought about a certain someone who I won't mention my name.
I think I know who it is.
Yeah, I know who it is. And then you have that thought, you need to recognize that it's just a thought, not that that's not a good thing to think about anybody, but just simply that it's a thought and come back to your breathing and try not to label it as either good or bad, but simply it's a thought.
Yep.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that again, Mary, that's the basic practice. And especially in meditation, because that's how we deepen concentration, no matter what it is. Even if we have a thought about an individual person that we know is shared by millions and millions of people, and again, I'm not talking about one specific person, but using the example, in our minds, we can just go down that whole story and disregard the fact that it's our thought of that person that's creating conflict in our mind, not the fact that everybody else agrees with us.
Is that also ill will?
Do.
You can just
yes.
label it as ill will. And
yeah.
then
we're going to talk about that maybe next week now. But yes, simply recognize that it's a disturbance in my mind. It's ill will towards another human being. Doesn't matter if it's justified or not. Ultimately, what I'm most concerned about in meditation is the present quality of my mind. I don't want to be distracted by by justifying my hatred towards someone else. Think about that. In my meditation practice, mm-hmm. no, I want my meditation practice for deepening concentration. Those other things that are the current political climate is something that we can then relate to in a mindful way. You know, it doesn't mean like we don't recognize that there's things going on in the world that are pretty dire, but we're no longer reacting to it. And so we can be better citizens, for one thing, because we're not losing our minds over something. But to answer your simple question, yes. When a thought arises, no matter what it is, we come back to the sensation of breathing. And then off our cushion, because we've developed that refined mindfulness, when immediate situations come up, we'll be able to deal with them in a much more realistic manner, too, without losing our minds off our cushion. But we have to train somewhere. That's what meditation practice is. It's a practice of training our minds to be concentrated.
Early on, I noticed for me that justification was just a big old red flag. Like, I think that was like an early learning for me. Like, when I'm feeling justified about anything, I'm off the path.
Yeah.
I'm
that's good.
Yeah.
And that was a big, you know, aha.
Or trying to justify.
Yeah.
Any effort around justification mm-hmm. is...
That's in the Loka Sutta, I think the Buddha says, where there's desire, there's fear. So notice when we have these types of fear-based thoughts, mm-hmm. that we use that situation. The more, here's the way I want to say it. The more extreme my reaction is to a situation, the more I need other people to pull other people
mm-hmm.
into that
mm-hmm.
reactive circle.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that just what's happening?
Yes.
Where there's desire, there's fear. So I might feel justified in feeling a certain way towards a person or a situation, but because I've now lost my mind, I need to attract and
right.
encourage other minds to do the same thing. Why? Because I'm scared, or I wouldn't feel this way in the first place.
I think that's why the Fourth Foundation, even though it was tricky, but now, as Jen said, you recognize that that's ill will. You recognize
yes.
that it's doubt. You recognize that it's restlessness. So there's value in understanding what the Buddha was teaching, but he's not teaching you to contemplate. He's teaching you that that's what you will see arise.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
if it was laziness, you recognize that. And if I didn't go through that process of kind of wrong approach toward the mindfulness teachings, I wouldn't then have been able to integrate it properly, because I don't follow that ill will to try to figure it out. I just recognize it as it arose. So again, it's very subtle, and it's an important, like, you could take weeks on just teaching that aspect of just the fourth foundation, that it's not this list to memorize and then contemplate. It's just to be aware that that's what arises.
Yeah.
Return to your breath. And that's the practice.
That's what arises and passes away. Yes, that's the practice. That is. And not get caught up in eye-making of any of that. It's just what's occurring. And it's occurring, why? It's occurring, life occurs because I have a life. It's not occurring to me. It's occurring because I happen to be here. And, you know, then we get to the great existential questions. The Buddha said, don't go there. It's just more eye-making. Like, why am I here? Even if I could know why I'm here, I mean, I'm here to teach
myself. You're still here.
Yeah, I mean, what?
That's right.
But the why, I used to have this Jesuit friend of mine who was a great guy, and he used to, he had 9 nervous breakdowns. I know they call him something different now, but that's what I, and he used to say, there's nothing wrong with losing your mind. You just get another one. and one thing, what I wanted to say, and he'd say, we used to have these great philosophical questions, and I always try to pin them down and explain to me where everything came from and why babies die, etc. And he'd say, John, if you want to maintain sanity, never ask why. I still remember him saying it. Never ask why. And it took me a long time. He said this over a series of years, and I never quite got it. In fact, I got it well after he passed. If I'm asking why, what I'm really asking is, where can I establish myself here?
Mm-hmm.
It's always a self-referential, unless you're Einstein, maybe. Why is this happening to me? It's not. It's happening. It's happening because I happen to have a life. That's it. I got these 6 properties. But the wonderful thing about what the Buddha realized, and the wonderful thing about having developed a refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, is I don't have to worry about it anymore. I can just enjoy what's occurring, no matter what it is. And we all talk about developing that. That's one of the things that is most remarkable about this Sangha. We all recognize that this is what's developing. Let me get to the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So we've talked about that. Again, we do this in meditation very quickly, not over the course of an hour and a half. We begin our meditation by being mindful of the breath in the body. And we, as that relates to jhana, we take pleasure in that first jhana, the directed thought of seclusion. Then the Buddha says, be mindful of feelings arising and passing away and thoughts arising and passing away. He doesn't tell us to do anything with them. Just notice that that's what's occurring. Why? Because as human beings, in a proper meditation practice, that's what's going to occur. Feelings will arise and pass away. Thoughts will arise and pass away. Recognize that it's occurring and come back to the sensation of breathing. That brings us directly to the second jhana that we talked about last week. Pleasure born of the act of concentration. It's a pleasurable feeling, isn't it? And it's nothing that we've all experienced that second jhana, what the Buddhists talk, we're all able to recognize and abandon feeling and thoughts arising and passing away, correct? And we come back to the sensation of breathing. It doesn't matter if it's for 1 breath, 2 breaths, or a half an hour worth of breath. We're doing the practice. We'll be able to do it for longer periods of time comfortably as we slowly add time to our meditation practice. If we do it all at once, we probably won't get there. The fourth foundation of mindfulness. Being mindful of the present quality of mind, determined and alert and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. This is what we talked about. When we can go through on our cushion, being mindful of feelings and thoughts arising and passing away, always coming back to the sensation of breathing, we will establish a well-concentrated mind. A well-concentrated mind is a mind that is at peace. Even if it's just on our meditation cushions, and maybe it's only just for a moment or two. But that present quality of mind, noticing the present quality of mind, is the fourth foundation of mindfulness. There's nothing here that the Buddha says, and then the fourth foundation of mindfulness must always be calm and peaceful. He could say it, couldn't he? If he was unrealistic. what he says is just notice it. If you've gone through this process, you've taken a breath, you've allowed feelings and thoughts arise and pass away, notice the present quality of mind. And if the present quality of mind is less than peaceful, what do we do with that?
Accept it.
Be at peace with it. It sounds a little crazy at first to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state, but that's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. We don't change it at all. Why? Because it's what's occurring. We learn in a very profound level the difference between approval and acceptance. I don't have to approve of what's occurring, but I accept it. Why? Why?
Because it's occurring.
Because it's occurring. It just made, I mean, isn't that the essence of sanity?
Mm-hmm.
I accept it because it's what's occurring. Is it? Doesn't mean, it doesn't mean it's approval. Approval is a function of a self-referential ego personality, isn't it? I want this to be different than it is. I want more or less of it or whatever it might be. The fourth foundation of mindfulness follows from being mindful of the breath in the body and not being distracted by what's feelings and thoughts arising and passing away, which is always so off our cushion. Feelings and thoughts arising and passing away are attached to what's occurring if we're stuck in wrong views of self. And so the present quality of our mind is going to be agitated.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just as important to recognize an agitated mind state as it is to recognize a peaceful mind state. When we find ourselves in an agitated mind state, to simply recognize it, and if we're fortunate enough that we can sit for a few minutes, do that, but at least understand it in the frame of reference of the Eightfold Path. Perhaps my mind is agitated because of my just momentarily previously wrong speech or wrong action or wrong livelihood or a wrong view of what's occurring. I despise that person in front of me. Well, okay, if I do that, my mind is going to be agitated, isn't it? And we want it, and a self-referential self wants to blame the person that I'm judging harshly for my agitation, don't we? Rather than recognize it's my harsh judgment that's agitating me.
Mm-hmm.
Taking control of our minds. Is that clear, that mm-hmm. little bit I threw in there at the end?
Mm-hmm.
That was very helpful.
Yeah, so our quality of mind is a direct result of not what's occurring outside. It's a direct result of what we're holding in mind inside. And we have, that's the ultimate choice we have moment by moment. What am I going to hold in mind? If I hold in mind, this is the essence of refined mindfulness. If I'm holding in mind the framework of the Eightfold Path for the way that I'm interacting and viewing myself in relation to the world, my mind will be at peace and I will be fully present with what's occurring without the need for it to be any different than it is. A dispassionate, selfless way, that's the essence of the Buddha's mindfulness. Okay. This is definitely going to be at least two parts, but I want to go just a little further. Because then I'm going to ask you to be more mindful of this in your meditation this coming week. The first foundation of mindfulness. And how does one remain mindful of the breath in the body in and of itself? Find a secluded spot, the shade of a tree or an empty hut or quiet place in our house. Sitting erect with legs crossed in front, if you can. You don't have to do that. And place attention on the breath. Remaining mindful of the breath, breathe in and breathe out. Mindful of the breath, long or short, breathe in and breathe out. The reason why that line is in there, and that's another line that is taken out of context, where whole traditions make up practices based on fabricated breaths, meaning I'll this meditation I'm going to fabricate long breaths and I'll focus on long breathing and what that feels like. That's just more I'm making. I think everybody here sees that. You're just manipulating your breath. Manipulating your breath in any way is a subtle and sometimes not so subtle form of eye making. And again, it's fine if you have a practice of doing that for some reason. Just make sure you don't conflate it with what the Buddha's teaching. However we find ourselves breathing, the first foundations of mindfulness says we simply acknowledge that we're breathing. Not long, short, it doesn't matter. Training yourself to be sensitive to the breath. Again, we're not sensitive to the breath just means to be aware that we're breathing. We're sensitive and conscious beings. We're using our senses properly that way. Sensitive to the breath and calming any bodily fabrication. So what it doesn't mean that I find myself a little jittery and okay, now I got to focus on not being jittery. It means that as a consequence of being mindful of the sensation of breathing in my body, bodily fabrication's calm. It's not a direct act. Again, a lot of meditations are taught Now go find pain here in your body, or focus on your knee, or focus on your ankle, or do a yoga nidra, which is a wonderful way to help yourself relax, if anybody knows it. I'm not saying don't do it, but don't do it as a meditation practice. When you meditate, it doesn't matter what you're feeling, where you're going, what you're thinking, whatever it is, come back to the sensation of breathing. And that will deepen concentration. Training yourself to be sensitive to the breath and calming any bodily fabrication as a result of concentrating on your breath. Ever mindful, calming the body with each in-breath and each out-breath. It's such an important line, and it emphasizes what I just said. Ever mindful of the breath. It doesn't say ever mindful of calming the body. Ever mindful of the breath, calming the body with each in-breath and each out-breath. Again, it's not something we're directing our thoughts to. We're directing our thoughts to our thinking. Remaining mindful of the breath in the body, mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, the arising and passing away of phenomena with regard to the body. Our meditation now is teaching us in a direct experiential way impermanence. The arising and passing away of the breath in the body is the direct experience, a practical expression of, and a metaphor for impermanence, isn't it? That's why it works. That's why it works so well. The Buddha continues, in this way, one remains mindful internally and externally with regard to the body. Remember in the sutta a couple weeks ago, what the Buddha teaches, internal and external is all, in, thinking about form, internal or external form. Internal and external form is just form. There's no, an external view is simply a view that is dissociated from its body. Right? Remember that, right? So if we're in our meditation and we got our thoughts, you know, floating around the cosmos or somewhere, there's nothing magical or mystical about that. It's just a thought. Come back to the sensation of breathing in your body. With no self-reference, calmly noticing there is a body. Right? Not negating the fact that there's a body, there is. Remaining independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. Concentration is the foundation that supports refined mindfulness. Being mindful of what is occurring in relation to the Eightfold Path is refined mindfulness. These are my words here. Being mindful of the breath in the body is the foundation of developing understanding of an ego personality and its relation to the distraction of stress. Being mindful of the breath in the body interrupts outer focus, clinging, and conditioned thinking, and begins to quiet the mind with directed inner mindfulness. That's relating again to that first, the first jhana. That initial action of being mindful in the breath seems so subtle and so common, it's familiar, we do it all the time, that it's easily overlooked how powerful that one beginning foundation is to all of the Buddha's Dhamma. And to do it correctly, what does that mean? To do it, being mindful of the breath correctly means to be mindful of the breath as it is in a dispassionate, selfless way. Being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath brings mindfulness to the arising and passing away of all phenomena. Notice that there is no specialness or applied emphasis attached to the normal breathing cycle. I just mentioned that a little earlier. Often when we strip away all the other self-referential things and all that we're left with is the breath, we want to make something special about the breath. I can't breathe. I'm too stressed to breathe. I can really breathe long breaths, or I can do a lot of short breath. Whatever it might be, we create a specialness over this simple practice. Let me skip ahead just a little bit. The Buddha continues, and this is another thing where there's a whole very popular lineage where walking meditation is substituted for sitting meditation. The Buddha taught in this sutta to be mindful of the breath in the body as a meditation practice, not to be mindful of your feet. And a consequence of a well-concentrated mind is that when we're walking, we're mindful that we're walking. But again, it's not a meditation practice, it's walking. The Buddha says, when walking, simply be mindful of walking. When standing, be mindful of standing. When sitting, be mindful of sitting. When lying down, be mindful of lying down. In any function, be mindful that there is a body. Again, those instructions are just to begin to unite the mind and the body. When we're walking, be mindful. That's what you're walking. Don't be thinking about, you know, whatever you might be thinking about. When you're lying down, you're lying down. your a well concentrated mind, when it's lying down, is just lying down, isn't it? The essence of concentration. When going about looking this way and that, be fully mindful that there is a body. When bending or reaching, be fully mindful. When carrying a bowl or a cloak, be fully mindful. When eating, drinking, or savoring food, be fully mindful. When eliminating waste, be fully mindful. When walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, walking, talking, or silent, be fully mindful. In other words, that's the essence of the Buddha's mindfulness that's developed on our cushion and then within the framework of the Eightfold Path. We then have the ability to be mindful with our life as our life occurs. In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the in-breath and the out-breath. In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the arising and the passing away of the body, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. Just being mindful of our breath trains us in that way. Just as a person with good eyesight emptying a bag full of mixed grains would know, well, this is wheat, this is rice, these are beans, these are sesame seeds. In the same way, one remains mindful from the soles of their feet to the tops of their heads, encased in skin. There is hair, nails, teeth, tendons, bones, marrow, organs, feces, phlegm, blood, urine, sweat, fat, tears, saliva, mucus, and fluid in the joints. Meaning, there's a whole meditation called Meditation on the Charnel Grounds in the cemetery, where we bring to mind in a graphic detail over and over and over again the different parts of the body and look at them as they decompose. The Buddha is simply using a decomposing human body to teach impermanence, and so that we stop being so enamored with this form, not as a meditation practice. In this way, one is mindful of the four elements that we talked about before. The four elements of the six properties that make up a human being. In this way, one is mindful of the four elements, the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the wind element, and those other two properties, the space and the consciousness property. Be mindful of impermanence of the body to develop dispassion, not to create further clinging to, oh my God, I'm going to start rotting away at some point. If left unattended, a corpse decays quickly. It becomes bloated and infested. It is picked at by birds and dogs and other creatures. Eventually, nothing is left but dust. Be mindful that this very body, too, will die and pass away. This is the nature of the world, an unavoidable fate. Again, it takes an awakened human being to emphasize that to us who don't want to face the fact that we are impermanent and at any moment the cow could get us. Why is the most important aspect of that in relation to Dhamma practice is so we understand we don't have forever to awaken, but we can do it in this lifetime if we get to it. In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the in-breath and the out-breath. In this way, one remains mindful of the arising and the passing away of the body, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the breath in the body. I'm going to ask you all just to be mindful. I'd like to get to a certain point in this sutta, but it's probably going to take me another 15 minutes to get there, and it's about 10 minutes to 10. So would it be best if I stop now and pick it up next week?
I'd appreciate you stopping. I think you've gone through a lot of information,
okay.
Right?
That's what I wanted to hear. So this is where I stopped at, where we'll pick up again next week, is mindfulness of feelings. But what I wanted to ask you then is to maybe review this and then mindfully bring it into your meditation practice as the Buddha described it right there, and then off your cushion. Just be mindful of your breath. If you find yourself caught up in the world, whether on your cushion or off your cushion, take a moment to take a breath and just remind yourself that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am, and then get on with your day. So that'll be part of our homework for this week, and then we'll do part two next week. Maybe part three the week after. Well, we had a great discussion, and I think we created developed a deeper understanding of the meaning of mindfulness and the importance, right? Okay, well, let's just go around the room and see what you think about that. Jen, good to see you this morning.
It's good to see you, John. It's good to be here. It's good to see everybody. So you always say that the Eightfold Path is a vehicle for recognizing mindlessness, right?
Yep.
So the four foundations of mindfulness are the instrument to get back within that framework.
Yes, it establishes your mind in a way that can incorporate or integrate the Eightfold Path.
So recognizing, or it just, conditions you, pardon that use, the use of that word, to, it conditions your being to be in your body.
Yeah.
Watch, breathe, allow feelings to arise and pass away, allow thoughts to arise and pass away, and notice what the breath and the thoughts and the feelings are, how they're impacting your mind.
Yeah.
And if you practice that on the cushion, then you're more likely to pick up that instrument off the cushion so that you can be in your body.
Yep.
Throughout your entire day.
It's just that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. A concentration practice establishes our mind and our body on our cushion so that we can take it off our cushion.
So
we've all experienced
all
that too.
All you have to do is breathe. All that's happening and all that has to happen is that breathe, or not even has to happen, but there's nothing to do.
Yeah.
There's nothing to figure out.
Right. Permission.
There's nothing to like analyze, even off your cushion. You know, if you're noticing that you're distracted or upset or worried or whatever, it's just breathe, feel, think, notice what those things are.
Yeah. Yeah, and continually remind yourself when you're caught up and entangled in the world that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not mine. It takes concentration to do that, and it takes the right framework to see that,
mm-hmm.
to see that eye making in it.
Yeah.
And it is entirely practical. It's the reason why the Buddha taught the way he taught, and we understand now that doing other things, such as a contemplation practice or counting, etc., is just a distraction from that goal. It can't deliver what is necessary for awakening as a Buddha describes awakening, because it's simply more distraction.
I've been noticing in the last week that if I think I tried to explain this last week a little bit, but I will try to use, you know, throughout my day, I'll try to, if I find myself getting, you know, frustrated with my boss or, you know, a student or whatever, just something that gets me going, that's when I most likely tend to recognize that I'm off the path or not being mindless.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I will tend to use, you know, I'll try to start explaining in my mind, this is just your ego and your eye making, and you're trying to, you know, this person has brought something up for you that that's all analyzing.
Yeah, that is.
And instead, I've just been kind of dropping into, you know, feeling. It's almost like a place where there's just no, there's no words for it. Just drop back into breath, feeling, thoughts, and just doing that for like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is that it just, I can can't even, there's no words to explain it, but it's been helpful, so thank you.
It's your practice.
Thank you.
Yeah, right.
That's your practice.
Yeah.
Instead of the 5-second rule or some other version of that, it's your practice.
Yeah.
And instead of contemplating it, you're just returning to your breath. It's exactly what's supposed to happen.
That's it. You're calming your mind by disentangling yourself from the situation. And the calm and peace naturally arises. That's not fabricated. It's not, I'm a Buddhist and I should feel calm.
Right.
you just feel calm because you're a Buddhist. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here. Well, you often say that the Buddha never wasted a word. Well, I think John Huswell doesn't either.
Some would argue that.
Yeah. No, I'd, you know, the way you explain very, very difficult things to wrap your head around, but you do explain them very well.
Thank you.
And I think this is a tape that I'm definitely going to listen to again. Just because there's the understanding is such a fine line between getting it right and getting it wrong. And this sort of talk has pointed to exactly what it is. So I definitely need to sit down quietly at home and play this tape again, and even take it bit by bit, you know, take it in chunks if I need to do, and to absorb the information, because it's been a great teaching on, a great teaching, you know, not to say that the others aren't either, but it covers a lot of very fine points. So I need to re-listen to it and absorb it again. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll have it posted probably by noon today, so you can listen to it again. But yeah, there's so much in this. Is one of the most important suttas of all of them. So thank you.
Okay.
Becky, good to see you.
So good to be back here. Hi, everyone. This was really, really helpful for me. I had several aha moments in my mind. I don't feel right now like I could re-describe them. I don't even know if I can hold on to them. But the fact that they occurred is very encouraging. I just came back from a 10-day stay with a very good friend, and I had some really difficult time. I had a difficult time there because I realize now of what was happening in me. I had a lot of trouble accepting what is happening with him. And this really helped me to be able to say, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. And I can't change it. The only thing I'm coming up against now is it was so hard for me to be there that I keep projecting, am I ever going to be able to hang out with him again, you know? And that's the thing that I am having trouble with now, but I realize that still I'm making. And I just have to accept what's happening now and not worry about what might or might not happen in the future. And so this was really helpful for me too. to sort of calm, you know, get back on the path with regard to this one issue that's been bothering me a lot. So thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Yeah, again, it's meant to be practically applied just in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. It's just 10 o'clock. Actually, it's 4 after. Does anybody have to go? I'll give you a chance to speak before you run out. Okay. We'll be done in, you know, just a few more minutes. So, Mary, good to see you.
Oh, good to be here. Good to see everyone. A little bit of what everyone has said, the, you know, permission to treat your thoughts not regally and not inferior, and they're just thoughts. And just to, like, zap the emotion out of all of that is very freeing.
Mm-hmm.
Same with feelings, right? Feelings are what emotions attached to a thought or whatever. You know, you're brought up a certain way and you think your feelings matter and you fight for those feelings.
Yeah.
And it's very refreshing to be able to put the practice in place and recognize things as they are and permission to do nothing about them, which is the non-reaction piece.
Yeah.
That as a grown adult I've had to learn. You know, but it's fascinating and helpful and hard and you know, all of those things. But it's as with any fundamentals in life, it's always important to return to the fundamentals, to continue to strengthen whatever you're doing, whatever practice or athleticism or leadership or anything. So very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it is. David, good to see you this morning.
Good morning. This practice is an exercise of replacing ignorance with wisdom,
mm-hmm.
and concentration, and mindfulness is the path to that. And recognizing and understanding the three marks, there's a lot involved with all these teachings, but it does come down to being mindful of the present moment. And these classes are just so helpful, and you do get something different out of it each and every time,
mm-hmm.
because your understanding grows and your concentration grows, so just thankful to be able to participate.
Thank you. Glad you're here. Kathy, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome back to our Sangha.
So this is all very new to me,
yeah.
But I just, in my mind, at emotional liberation,
yeah.
the whole concept of what you're teaching. I'm just new to it, a new student, but that's just my, just makes it an easy way to live.
Yeah, it does, and that is the point. Did I cut you off? I'm sorry.
No, I have nothing else to say.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, emotional liberation. Because my description of an awakened human being is someone who has gained full human maturity. That's what that is. You know, we're not driven by our emotions, by how we feel, or how we think about how we feel. We're just simply mindfully present with a calm and peaceful mind. And it really isn't all that much more than that. But the profound wisdom of Siddhartha Gautama was that he understood it wasn't enough to just say we could be like this. He understood that we can't unless we address the problem of ignorance of the way things are. And that's the Eightfold Path. So it's a little bit more than just thinking about how we should be, but there's a clear and direct path. And to me, that's one of the most remarkable things of my lifetime, that these teachings from 2,600 years ago are still available and effective today, you know, in any situation.
It's difficult to accomplish, but it's easy to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a lot easier
wow.
than not.
Pretty
you know,
good.
I mean, living without
That was the middle way.
Yeah, and living without the knowledge of what we're living in is really difficult.
Yeah.
And it's impossible. And so it is much easier to understand once we get past some conditioned views. It's just a common, peaceful way of living our life.
Yes.
And so who wouldn't want it? So
it's nice.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad you. Yeah. I'm glad you came. You came at a good time too, as we're going through the book again.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm glad you're here, Mary. Good to see you.
Good to be here. As usual, I come out of here feeling a lot more hopeful than when I came in. And I just need to hold in mind these teachings and how easy it is to get mired in whatever is going on, even if it's my own, you know, being in a very down mind state and just recognizing this is where I am.
Yeah.
And instead of fighting it, I mean, it's so silly to fight it because it always passes.
Yeah.
So you might as well just not make it worse by sticking the second arrow in.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the quickest way to do that, and most effective, is to come back to what's occurring right now.
Yeah.
In a dispassionate way. Thank you, Mary. Glad you're here. Kevin, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you, John. Again, I'm awed by all the wisdom that comes out of this Sangha.
It is.
It's
amazing.
Just the depth of feeling and understanding is amazing.
Mm.
And then, you know, it's great to see, to go through this again. It's the beginning teaching, and every time I sit down to meditate, I think I feel like a beginner. And then, you know, going through this for a couple of years now and several times, I just, and with your teaching, it's just amazing how differently I view it from when I first.
Yeah, always evolving.
It's true.
Yeah, it is. It's just you've all heard my story. I was involved in Buddhism for so many years, just getting more and more confused and frustrated and couldn't understand what I was doing. And then I came across what the Buddha actually taught, and it changed everything. And everything that he teaches, talk about not wasting a word, every single thing that he teaches is practically applicable to a human life. There's no dross. It's just, this is, and you can, as we go through the rest of this, might be even two more weeks, the different themes that the Satipatthana Sutta addresses, every one of those themes is in a way a complete practice, as long as you understand the context, like the five hindrances, or the seven factors of awakening. You know, it's just remarkable. The retreat registration is open. Please sign up. If you're coming, sign up as soon as you can, because it helps me out an awful lot. And our teacher training is ongoing right now. We started it this year. The requirements are on the website. It's not just for people that want to teach others in this setting. It's also going to be a very useful teacher training for just one-on-one. Maybe your friends, how to explain it to friends or families, etc. So it's geared that way too. We'll finish with metta as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture. And these are the Buddha's words in metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.